thank you for coming back in.
Thanks for inviting me back, Rod.
That was great.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you. I got in trouble. One from you, you sent me a scathing WhatsApp to say, I'm very disappointed you didn't record, and I've got to take that on the chin, but I wasn't shown how to do it, so I apologise. Not trying to duck it. It is on now, John. So I had a few people say to me, I've heard about this John Quirk. Did you record it? Did you put it on the site so we can go and listen to it? We were working. I said, no. So I got in trouble in the street. So it's on now. What we're going to do, John, if you don't mind, we're going to retouch on that so people, if they're working today or they haven't got an opportunity to listen live, they can go and catch up. Because otherwise, if we move on from where we were going from Malaysia straight to Australia, and there was a lot happening. So, right, let's give a quick background again from Irishman with no accent, straight down to Southampton schooling, and then on to Liverpool.
Excellent. I've had a very fortunate life. You know, I was well-schooled, well-educated, and had a lot of fun in my schooling years in England. Yeah. A young Irish lad in England, school in Southampton, university in Liverpool, played a lot of sports and had a lot of fun. And qualified as a young chartered accountant in late 70s, 1977, must have been, 77. And at the time, Britain was bankrupt. You know, times change. IMF was, you know, ruling the country with an iron fist. Scargill had happened. The country had gone berserk. It had too many freebies, too many handouts, and the country was bankrupt. So there was a wage freeze. So in the old days, before the wage freeze, you qualify as a chartered accountant, your salary goes up pretty astronomically.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do that. So
because they just ran out of cash.
They just had no cash. It was a wage freeze, and everyone had to bear the pain.
Yeah.
So I was with Coopers and Lybrand, and I had a call out of the blue. I was up at the north of Scotland at Doonray, which is a submarine and nuclear facility. And how do I fancy a few months in the sunshine in Africa? I said, where? They said Botswana. I didn't know where Botswana was. My partner I was talking to, he didn't know either. He said he thought it was near Libya. How wrong can you be? So the upshot was that in October 78, I stepped off the plane in Habaroni, and my life changed.
What age were you then, do you say?
I would have been 26.
26.
Yeah.
Young man, yeah.
Yeah, and given up any aspirations of playing, you know, serious sport. It was career. I was met at the airport by the partner who was I was supposed to be replacing for 3 months. He gave me the office keys and said, John, I'm not coming back. There's the keys. You'll be opening up on Monday. And that totally changed my life.
No handover, nothing for a week or anything?
Nothing like that at all.
Here's the keys. Good luck, young fella.
Hadn't met anybody else in the office. Knew nothing.
That
quite unbelievable.
What year was this? 70s?
1978.
78. Sure.
The Botswana. I need to paint the picture of what Botswana was. Botswana did not exist as a country until 1966, when it was given independence. Before that, it was the protectorate of Bechuanaland.
Wait, explain that to me. The protectorate, what does that mean?
It meant that the then Bamangwato tribal leaders in the 1880s flew across to London and begged for help and support and security from the Great White Queen, Queen Victoria. They were under pressure. Afrikaners were pushing up. Paul Kruger was looking at expanding into there, as was Cecil Rhodes.
Oh, the guy who did the falls.
Absolutely.
Zimbabwe, yeah.
And as were the Zulus. And people forget that. If you go back and see what the Bamangwato wanted protection from, it was actually mostly the marauding Zulus.
And coming up or coming down from the north?
They were coming. They were coming down. They're coming down through Zimbabwe. Yep. It obviously started in West Africa.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful ethnographic map or linguistic map of the movement of the tribes, of the Bantu tribes through Africa. It was done by Murdoch, a guy called Murdoch, and if you look it up, and it's fascinating to look at it, and you can see the move of the Bantu people down from West Africa. But this was a sort of backwash, and they were looking at, they had some land in what is modern day Botswana, and the Botswana people were generally considered, non-aggressive. They had vast areas of land, but they were not a fighting people. They were pastoralists. The whole of Bechuanaland was effectively one great cattle ranch. Not individually farmed off. Cattle ranging everywhere. The Okavango did not exist as a separate identity, nor Savuti, nor Maremi, nor the Tuli. It was just one great cattle ranch, owned by one individual in the north, a European guy.
Sorry to interrupt. What made the Zulus from West Africa come all the way down to South Africa? What was it? Why were they not happy up there? Sorry, excuse my ignorance.
Well, they were looking for land. They were generally nomadic. They did not farm on a permanent basis. So you used up a bit of land and you moved on.
But West Africa, that's a fair way up, isn't it?
And they didn't come. Obviously, the Sahara Desert's impinging as well, and the Congo.
Yeah.
So they came, and they initially went into East Africa, and that was the first areas that they. It's not quite the right word, but colonized,
right.
Took over.
Yeah.
And then they moved south, and they moved south pretty much to as far as the Fish River. And then they looked at this open land. I think the population of Botswana in 1966 at independence was only about 500,000 or 600,000. Even in 1980, it was around about 800,000. At the end of the 80s, in 1990, it was about 1.2 million. So it's a relatively sparsely populated, agrarian community, heavily into cattle. Botswana Meat Corporation, even today in Lebatsi, is a major operation, and it's premium beef that goes mostly almost exclusively into Europe. I don't think you see any down here. They do a wonderful corned beef called Echo Corned Beef, best in the world. If you ever get a chance to find it. And that's what Botswana was at independence. To go to Gaborone, the capital, the population was probably, when I arrived in 1970, was probably about 50,000. It had almost no tar, just a little bit of tar around the central bit, around the main shopping mall. There were no supermarkets. Only one hospital, fairly run down. Very few schools, and it was a very, very undeveloped piece of land. The ruler from independence until 1980, when he sadly died, was Sir Sibetse Khama. He'd qualified as a barrister in London. He was a very wise man. He actually married an English woman, Ruth Williams. That caused a lot of controversy.
I did it.
Absolutely. It was diplomatically very difficult because Britain had a reasonably close relationship with South Africa in the 1940s. I think they married in 1949. And so a white woman married to a black man was a very, very touchy subject.
Frowned upon a bit, yeah.
So for a long, long time, Sibetse Khama could not even live in the Bechuanaland Protectorate. He spent they spent most of their formative years in England. He was a barrister, and they had I think the kids were born across there. I think that's true. Mm. And they only really came back and set up in Botswana post 1966, when he became by popular vote, overwhelming vote, the first president. And and they lived in the village of Seroe, where he grew up, where the Bamangwatu tribe's headquarters were. An idea in 1963, I think it was 1963, before Botswana existed as a country, the African Union held one of their jamborees in then Bechuanaland, in a place called Molopololi. Molopololi was picked, it was the biggest traditional village in Africa. The Rondavel, reed huts, and it had 30,000 people.
Jeez.
Which is a big,
yeah,
big village.
It is, yeah.
And that's where Seretse started. So the country that he inherited was mostly agricultural, very little industry, very little schooling, and that's what he started to build on. When I got there in October 78, that's really what the country was. There was the start of there was a small industrial area, and some companies there. The company that I was working for, we had quite a lot of companies there, including we had one called Kalahari Ford, where one of the Seretse sons worked, Tony. He was the expert on repairing Ford. And the other one, Shikedi, worked at Lion Motors, who did the Peugeot.
Oh, there you go.
Both were absolutely car mad, and all they wanted to do was tinkle with cars and understand them.
Brilliant.
The elder son was Ian Carmer, and he was in the Botswana Defence Force at the time. And the reason, and I became quite familiar with him, because we took over the company that I was working for. We bought the assets of a company that had gone bust.
Belly up, yep.
Batoga Construction. And their contract that finished them off was building the Defence Force base at Mohoditzani, which we finished off, made money on the whole time, exactly the same contract. And that was the start of developing a company called Wade Adams, which became the biggest construction company in Africa outside of South Africa at the time. Our bread and butter was building houses for the Botswana Housing Corporation. That was largely funded by Swedish aid money. A lot of the problems that South Africa has experienced were sidestepped, because all of the housing, let's call them estates that were built, they weren't estates. They were just part and parcel of Habaroni, the capital. They were all mixed. They'd have low-cost, medium-cost, and high-cost housing in appropriate ratios.
Yeah.
So you didn't get a ghetto situation.
Yeah.
I think over the years, we built 500,000 houses.
Jeez.
So it's a major part of the development was building infrastructure in those formative years. We built most of Zwaneng, one of the new mines. We put the road into from Zwaneng through to Kang and on to Gobabis that linked him with Namibia.
What did they mine up there, John? What was their core?
Diamonds.
Oh, diamonds.
Diamonds. Mapipi, and that was the major diamond mine. But the Zwaneng was also. They had the two biggest diamond mines in the world, and they were, and the government was prescient enough to go into partnership with De Beers, so it was a 50-50. Just coming back to Bechuanaland, up until 1966, was administered from Mafeking, not even within the territory of modern-day Botswana. So when Botswana kicked off and got independence in 1966, there was almost no base of skills, administrative skills, government skills, any kind of skills.
So how did it work?
They relied very heavily. They had seconded to them very many British civil servants. And they were not only, I mean, the civil service was run by Colin Dixon Warren, a guy I got to know very, very well. I was best man when his daughter, Debbie, married Jack Holmes's daughter. Jack Holmes was one of the triumvirate of Anglo directors under J. Ogilvy, Ogilvy Thompson. So it's one of the reasons that we had such a very successful rugby team in Botswana. There were an awful lot of expatriates.
That's it, yeah.
We had the whole developed all the computer systems from scratch, a team of those. Governments, customs, police, army, they were all seconded.
From the British?
Mostly British.
Yeah.
This guy called Herman from the World Bank ran the Botswana Minister of Finance and their Reserve Bank. But they recognised that A, they had to develop schools, and they had to start educating their people. They were rural people, cattle based.
Well, they were farmers, weren't they?
Absolutely.
What's that word they use?
Pastoralists.
Is that the word?
That'll do. Yeah.
I was trying to think of that other word when you just farm for you and your little community.
Subsistence.
That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, because that's great doing that. But when you've got, as your population grows, you obviously got to do commercial farming to make sure you can feed your people. Or in those days, they just do for their little village.
I would say it was community based. It wasn't individual. That they would farm as a community. As a village.
Yes,
And they would all muck in. So the kids would go off and herd the cattle.
Yep.
From time to time and protect the cattle and
keep the
lions off them and that kind of stuff. Because don't forget, Botswana
is a game park.
It's pristine game park, and it's one of the problems now. The conflict between particularly elephant and human communities. Yep. And you can see sympathies both ways. It's all very well, we in the rich countries or here in South Africa can say, just put up with them, But when it's your crop and your family and your community is dependent upon that crop, it's a bit tough when the elephants come in and run amok.
Well, it's like a bank robber, isn't it? Going, your cash is in the bank, and they say, we're going to borrow that. Absolutely.
So Botswana was a very interesting place. Obviously, it was a listening post. South Africa was going through change. It was already happening.
Yeah.
There were signs that things were changing. So it was almost every community was represented. The diplomatic corps in Gaborone was... I think there were 140 odd, which is pretty much all the countries of the world in those days.
Yeah.
So it was quite a dynamic international community, very small, almost a rail siding type of place, not much else.
Oh, really? So that's interesting, because I love trains. And so where did that go from, and where did it stop? Did it go up to West Africa, the line, or where did it...
Well, the terminal was Gaborone, and it went up, and the line that operated was Rhodesian Railways back in those days.
Right.
And they were both passenger and goods trains going up through Botswana to Francistown and across the border into I think it was then Rhodesia, Zimbabwe.
Yeah,
was it in that transition period onto France to Bulawayo, and then onto
actually Zambia?
It didn't. It went across the bridge. Into Zambia.
Yeah.
But most stuff was railed up. It was roaded up. So as Botswana was developing in the 80s. Huge, great freight trucks were running. It was major businesses just freighting up, goods, consumer goods, food, supermarket stuff, construction materials, etc. All just heading up, and the country was growing apace. But Botswana, I was going to start by actually just talking about something that I saw and read this morning, and it was an article on compromise. That compromise is the heart of all our relationships, interpersonal, societies, countries, we all have to make compromises. But for many, many people, compromise comes with reluctance. You know, it's kind of, I'm right, mine is the way, and compromise is reluctance. Botswana was forced to compromise and acquire skills to run government, to run all the aspects of government and security, etc., etc., because they just didn't exist. And in some ways, starting with a clean slate made it easier for Botswana than, for instance, in South Africa.
Because you're saying they had no structure in place, so this was the starting point, and that's what they adopted.
Pretty much so, you know. And but the advantage of that, and the assistance with running the civil service, only really ended towards the end of the 1990s.
Jeez.
It was obviously run down.
Yes.
But I know, for instance, the customs union was still run by a friend who was there until 1999-2000. And obviously, customs revenue, because Botswana was part of the common revenue area, Botswana had to fight to get its share out of South Africa. And obviously, the goods that came through South Africa and ended up in Botswana, that you know, all duty should have gone to them. That's but that was that they had to fight for that.
The mines up there with the diamonds, did De Beers come in and take that over, or how did that work?
Well, they were developed by De Beers.
Oh, okay, right.
But fairly early on, and so over the late I think Minorco was formed in late 70s, 76, 77, 78. Minorco was the offshore wing of Anglo-American, into which all of their non-South African businesses were put. They set up a central buying operation originally based in Antwerp, where all the diamonds mined in South Africa and in Botswana were stockpiled and in the central selling organization, and effectively exported at time of mining. So the CSO funded that.
So did Botswana get a share of coming out of their ground? Did they get rights or royalties or whatever?
50-50, 50-50 JV.
So they got their share.
They got a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it worked very much to Botswana's advantage, because they got paid as it was mined, effectively. And so the cash up front, and that was a big part of the revenues that was enabled Botswana to develop.
Right.
Houses built, etc., etc.
Okay, that's the question I was going to ask, because obviously that must have been quite big money for that newly developing country at the time, I would imagine. Did they take the money, steal it, waste it, or, as you were saying, did they just realise they've got to use that money and start expanding so they can grow as a country?
I think Nelson Mandela, he said that the greatest African, in his view, was Sir Seretse Khama. He was wise, he was fair, and certainly every single cent that was government, it came into government coffers, was used wisely. Obviously, there's always human nature.
Yeah, yeah.
But as it was. Was most certainly the most corruption-free government anywhere in Africa, and it was a shining example and beacon that sadly South Africa
didn't adopt that.
Didn't follow that.
No, it's a pity, isn't it? You know, because like we got so much gold down here. We've got diamonds.
Yeah.
We've got iron ore. We're a very mineral-rich country in South Africa. I'm not jumping away from Botswana, just comparing the two, that we should be so wealthy down here. Or am I getting that wrong?
Well, even Ruth Williams, or Ruth Khama, as she's now known, and the kids, they all still live a reasonably traditional Botswana life. They have, you know, the state house is a little bit grander than.
Sure.
But they live in the village of Soroe, amongst ordinary people. There's no airs or graces about them. And he's, you know, a highly qualified man. And
well, he's a barrister.
He's a barrister. Yeah. He was a very successful barrister. Who gave up a lot for his people. And the same, Ian Khama has been accused by some of, you know, stealing some money, but I think that's just politicking. I think that, you know, the whole family, I think, are, you know, they have you know, Botswana's interests at heart, and that's all you can really ask from leadership, that they take the right decisions for the right reasons for the benefit of the country. And I mean, that's quite rare. I mean, we see in America these days, you know, and Putin is probably one of the most corrupt people in the world. It's almost the exception that government is good and clean. And Botswana is, and certainly was and is, a shining example to all of Africa.
Still today?
I think so, yes. Yeah. I think so. The person that took over from Seretse Khama in mid-1980 was a guy called Kwet Masiri. And I got to know him quite well. Very quietly spoken, very moderate person. Not showy, not...
Did he listen? Like, if you had an opinion, would he say, no, we're not doing that, we're only doing this? Or would he... Or the people listen and say, this has been tried before, it didn't work. Now, if you're going to go and do it again, you're going to run into a brick wall and do the same thing over and over again. Or was the... As you found it, because you work with the people, you understood the people, were they very open to advice?
The Khotla... In Botswana is a village meeting, and the Khotla is not only village based, it's community based and country based, and as well as elected members of parliament, the Khotla was a very, very important sounding board to ensure that the interests of the people were considered. And that still pervades today. We don't have the same distance between government and the people as exists here. I mean, to try to get... When was the last time that President Ramaphosa actually had a dialogue?
Oh, well, he's got it coming up. He wants to spend $700 million to have a chat to some people about what they're not going to do.
Well, that's not a conversation. That's just somebody on a platform.
Exactly.
You know, talking to people.
Exactly.
Not with, talking to.
Sure.
It's very, very different.
It's a pity,
Yeah, and that's, I think, fundamentally the reason that Botswana has been the great success story of Africa and continues to be. That and its low population. It's very, very, very hard for any government, any country, to grow and create jobs and opportunity when the population is growing exponentially. And so you end up with a bottom-heavy demographic distribution. Half of South Africa's population are under 20. You know, they're still in the formative years.
Correct.
They're still in education or the early days of acquiring skills. And it means that it's very draining. It's very difficult. There's a continual need for more schools, better teachers, and I think the quality of teachers leaves a lot to be desired here. And
well, here's the thing for me. You're from England. Or Ireland, England, you spread around, and Africa. I'm from Oz. I mean, if you went in Australia, listen, Australia's woke as hell now. I mean, it's so woke. I like I said, my 2.5 years there, not the country I remember, my mate. It's not even close. But that's just my personal opinion. A lot of people love living there.
Yeah.
But if you went to them and said, we're going to drop the education standard to 30% and you get a pass, even the woke people would say, no, you can't do that, because how are we going to get people into these jobs? As people are retiring, we've got to be filling the gaps. We've got to be educating our people properly. So, and I'm not blowing smoke up your bottom, but in your position, you went at a young age, took over that job, but as you get to retirement age, there's got to be another one coming through the ranks that you're mentoring, training up, that you've got trust in and the company has trust in, that they can just hand the reins over, he understands or she understands, whoever it may be. But we're getting to the stage now, and it's like even YouTube in America, and I watch those ones, that guy who teases everybody goes on campus and asks some simple questions, like how many dimes in a dollar, and they say 30. Yeah, so if you're dumbing down your people, and that's a terrible word, it's an American word, dumbing down, but if you're dumbing down your people, how do you expect to have people come through the ranks and be able to take over of people in trust, as you were mentioning now, and to do the right thing? All they're looking at now is, if you get into politics, you can do pretty well for yourself. Not about your salary, but what you get on the side. And that seems to be a wrong thing to portray to the youth. I don't know what your feelings are.
Well, let's just go back and talk about Botswana and contrast Botswana and South Africa.
Please.
So Botswana had a long period of transition. It had no tradition or experience.
Yes.
And it recognized that. It needed to develop schools. It needed to develop universities. And that's a university is a very interesting point. A university is an expensive thing. They didn't have a university of their own. They had a BLS structure. And BLS stands for Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. And they had campuses in all three countries that did some of the disciplines. So, I can't remember which ones do. I know they did law and medicine in Botswana. Swaziland had other specialties, and Lesotho had other specialties, and the citizens of all three went to the appropriate university, which is a very, very effective way of spreading skills. I had friends, another reason that we had a great rugby team, the law professor was a great rugby player.
Oh, really?
He could have been, perhaps would have been, the next hooker, a Kiwi hooker. But he came and he lectured to the students for very little money because it's something he believed in. It was, you know, and then contrast that with South Africa. Initially, we had a government of national unity. Derek Keyes was the Minister of Finance, and the skills were appropriately spread around. And that continued into the Nelson Mandela era. Thabo Mbeki changed all that pretty much as the 21st century kicked in. Wholesale change. Compulsory retirements of many, many civil servants, head of police, the army, all the parastatals, etc., etc. Now, put yourself, you're a young South African. You might have a degree, or you might have some formal qualification, but you have no experience. And you're thrown in the deep end to run organizations like Eskom that's been gutted of all its experienced old hands. And you, inexperienced, callow youth, are being asked to run that.
See, that's what...
It's madness.
It is.
It just doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
And you can't put that through all the, you know, the layers of society, all the facets of society. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
And clearly, and then add to that, you know, the ANC cadre deployment.
Yeah.
And you think of the history of the ANC. Mm. You think of somebody like, I'll pick somebody who was in the ANC, no longer is, Julius Malema.
Yeah.
He joined the ANC at the age of 6.
Yeah.
It was his education. The only book he ever probably read was the Stalinist Handbook on How to Govern. He had no life experience, and yet he and his fellow colleagues within the ANC appointed themselves to run almost everything.
He was in charge of the youth league.
He was in charge of the youth league.
Yeah.
That's where he came. You know, youth in South African terms is anyone under about 45.
That's right. They still call you a boy, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you think about, you know, the present ANC government. That's all the life they've ever known. They have no life experience at all. The ANC is their life. They have very little of the practical skills required to run a business or to run anything. And yet they do, and they have. I think that the Zondo Commission estimated that 1.5 trillion was trashed. 1.5 trillion.
How much went to Dubai? Did a bit go over there?
Well, if you recall Julius Malema coming on Radio 702 at the time, and he was talking about they were still fastening up the tailgates and still loading in the loot when the last plane flew out of the military at
The one where the Guptas flew in for the wedding.
Absolutely.
What's that one called? Waterberg or something like
Water.
Something like that. Yeah.
Edge of Pretoria. Yes. Yeah. And so we can only guess. I mean, on that subject, what happened to the Libyan Gaddafi loot? The last person that we know had it was Zuma, because Gaddafi entrusted it to him.
Sure, wasn't he?
And funnily enough, no one has seen any sign of it ever since.
Hold that thought, John. We've been going for just over half an hour now. Very interesting. We haven't gone far, which is cool because I'm enjoying it thoroughly. Going to just go to a short break and play a song. Right, welcome back. We've still got John with us. Very interesting. We haven't gone very far, but John said no, he doesn't mind coming in and chatting and telling about the history. And isn't it interesting for me, and I don't want to start there, just in my head, because everyone kept telling me no, that the Zulus, the Khoisas, this was their land and whatever. It's interesting you telling me they come from west of Africa. I didn't know that. I thought it was more the eastern side up above Kenya, but very interesting, and thanks for pointing that out to me. And then they moving down, and then you're saying, well, the Botswana people, which weren't called that in those days, I can't remember that name. What is it again?
It's interesting. The country is Botswana.
Yes.
The people are Batswana,
yeah,
or Motswana.
And the previous name before they got Botswana? I keep forgetting.
Bechuanaland.
That's it.
Bechuanaland. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Where were we before we went to a short break and wet our whistles? Where were we?
I just want to... the reason that I'm talking about Botswana,
yeah,
and the reason that I started on reconciliation, President Ramaphosa is very strong on this national dialogue.
Yeah.
He's going to spend $700 million on a national dialogue.
Yeah.
There's precious little point in talking unless people understand what has happened, why it's happened, why other countries have succeeded, what they did differently, and what we could do differently going forward. The second best time for change, obviously the first best time for change is as the event that needs changing occurs,
yeah,
but the second best time for change is now. And quite clearly, our interactions with America and the world tells us we are very seriously on the wrong path. We're beating the old cadre deployment, BEE drum, and quite clearly, it hasn't resulted in economic growth. In fact, the reverse. Our per capita national product is declining, has declined, and is continuing to decline. So we need to do something differently. And so if we're going to have, if the national dialogue is going to add up to anything more than just a talk shop,
yeah,
we need people to be informed. What are the choices? What have we done wrong? What do we need to change, and how do we make the future better? And that's the reason that I wanted to go back and concentrate on Botswana, and where I started with just a comment on reconciliation. Mm. I think there are lessons to be learned there, and it's a neighbour. It's not as if it's the other side of the world. They're fellow Africans. They are our closest neighbour. So I wanted to go back there, but perhaps now we need to move on.
But do you, okay, you spend 700, it'll be more than that, because someone will want a bottle of this and a couple extra feeds and bring a few friends. Oh, sorry, I'm just joking. But listening to what he said from the White House to since he's been back, since he's just come back from BRICS, right? he doesn't seem to want to change. Or, I heard a very good comment the other day, they're calling him the chameleon. Did you hear that one?
Yes.
Yeah, that when he goes to America, he'll say what he wants, make them happy. Then he goes to Brixton, you know, pats them on the back and does that. He doesn't seem to have a real opinion. He just goes with the flow and tries to get what he can.
I think there's an awful lot of truth in that. I think the recent BRICS meeting in Brazil was actually fairly muted, though. They recognise as a community. There was no comment directly from our president, but they recognise there's no future in prodding the bear.
No, exactly.
It's a small world. We're all in it together, and we need to get on and trade with each other, etc., etc. I think there was some relatively encouraging signs there. I think that the bull in the China shop is obviously President Trump, and it's very difficult. They used to say of Ronald Reagan, the only two people who knew what was in his mind was Nancy, because she'd put it there, and the last person he spoke to. And I think Trump's a bit the same. You know, he just spouts the first thing that comes into his mind, and often I think he regrets it.
Oh, right. Well, he's tweeting and all that stuff.
It's
social or something, isn't
it? It's madness, you know. Yeah. Just consider. Just think about what you're going to say, you know. So maybe I think that as a world, I think we got in the last year or so very, very close to World War III.
I
think that there were signs all over the world of extreme strain, but I'd like to think that Putin knows that he can't continue in the Ukraine. He just can't afford it.
Well, I was
it's bankrupting
ask
his country.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It's astonishing how many of his ministers have shot themselves through the head in the last couple of months.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. All committing suicide, sure. Jumping from buildings. It's quite remarkable.
I haven't really followed the Russian story. Obviously, what I see on, you know, whatever news thing I'm following, but I mean that country should have been taken over quickly. With the size of Russia compared to you, not talking about landmass, I'm talking about arms and whatever. I know that America or whatever is supplying them with arms, Ukraine, to keep them alive. But the wars, they thought they'd come in, steamroll them and take it over. Is that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. But so, yes, it's laid bare the fact that that Russia does have a huge arsenal. But a big chunk of that, A, is now being wiped out, B, was relatively antiquated, and is no match for modern weaponry.
Yeah.
And also, when you're fighting a country, and Ukraine is a country, it's not the Ukraine, which is, you know, Russia, it deems it to be part of Russia. Ukraine is a much, much older country than Muscovy, which is the heartland of Russia. Obviously, they were both part of the old USSR.
Yes, that Iron Bloc. Yeah,
the Iron Bloc.
Yeah.
But Ukraine has always been, and it was. It's an older religion. It's an older country. It's got more traditions. Many of the Russian folklore songs and stories are actually Ukrainian. The Cossacks were great warriors, you know, and people fighting for their country.
Hmm.
You don't want to, you know, they fight a bit harder than conscripts fighting for something that perhaps they don't believe in.
Yeah.
And I think that that's played out in Ukraine. So I think there are signs, no real grounds, but I think there are signs that a truce and peace is not that far away in Ukraine, and not before time.
Well, the one thing I really wanted to ask you today, and I was sitting at home having a nice glass of wine, actually I had a rum and coke, last night, and just looking at what we are doing as a country, okay, we're not happy with what we're getting, but we didn't go and negotiate and we didn't work that out, okay, that's fine. And there is an imbalance of payments, that there's the trade is in favour of South Africa, correct? The America buy more of their produce, although I did hear a podcast this morning that said, well, look at Google, look at Netflix, look how many people pay for all these services, they weren't included, which is a fair point. But the thing I'm going to go to you, John, is that, okay, things haven't worked out, so as you rightly said, if you keep poking the bear, you keep doing it. And as you said, Trump's quite a volatile guy, you know. If you keep poking him, annoying him, he'll just make a rash decision, and that's going to take a while to unwind if you do that. But we're still supporting all the enemies of the West. But in the meantime, we're saying, why don't we get your support? So what's your take on that?
I think that Trump is not the wild card that he's sometimes made out to be. He represents pretty much broad Republican American views. They don't want to get involved in wars.
No.
They want to, they believe that they can make everything, and they just they want to rule the world. Mm. But they don't want to take on extra responsibilities. Just leave America alone,
yeah.
and they'll be fine. They don't want to be the world's policeman. You know, they've been that for the since the Second World War.
And they've won none of those wars.
And yeah. they've won none of the wars.
No.
And they've made a pretty much a hash of everywhere they've set foot.
And they haven't had to defend their own territory. Like no one's invaded them.
Absolutely. Grenada was almost a, yeah. Reagan was called up Maggie and said, "How do we sort out Grenada? You sorted out the Argentinian situation."
Oh yes, what was that called? Falklands.
Falklands.
That's
yes.
That's right. Yes.
We can't even win in Grenada. What are we doing wrong? We had our asses whipped in Afghanistan and Vietnam and.
But no one's actually come. No. Or Cuba. Wasn't it? Cuba was that JFK's days, wasn't it?
That was.
He
was
when the missile, Russians had put the missiles there. Is that
1960, I think.
There you go.
And and that was touch and go for a long time.
Yes.
And obviously that would have been such a short range, intercontinental, missiles from Cuba would have been on New York or Washington. Well, an hour.
Oh, is it that far away?
It was probably.
I've been to America. I only went to Disneyland, so excuse my dumbness. But anyway.
No, I mean, because obviously in today's hypersonics, it is a couple of minutes, But
in those days,
not so much so.
Right, so we got off the subject a little bit, right? But I think everything that we're doing in South Africa at the moment, if we just keep poking and doing, and instead of just shutting up and going over quietly and saying, you know what? Because Trump's come out with the 4 points. If you don't do this, 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 and this, sorry, you're going to get 30 plus you're going to get 10 because you're shooting your mouth off about BRICS and whatever. I'm just saying what mm-hmm. I listened to yesterday. And they got their letter. So where do they go? They signed that letter for Iran. Do you see that? They signed it to say, oh, we feel so sorry for you and whatever. They're supporting everyone the West doesn't want to support. And I don't know what your point is. And listen, I shouldn't say anything because you're the expert. But what Trump did by taking out, we think he took them out, those potential they could make a missile, in Iran, did you agree it had to be done? Because they're radical people, those, and it's nothing them to fire one. The next thing that's on for young and old, isn't it? Once one get fired, they're going to be fired all over the world.
Well, it only that's the thing. It only takes one missile to trigger a world war.
That's it.
And
so, no one wins that.
The titular head of Iran came on. He confirmed that their nuclear program has been very severely set back.
I haven't seen that.
That was only today.
Oh, right.
He said, we can't even access the sites presently.
Oh, the ones at the tunnels under the mountain.
Yeah. So, it's set back a long, long time.
Thank goodness.
We don't know where the fissile material is.
Mm. Because there was reports satellites were picking up a lot of trucks before the explosion were around the entrances. Now, were they getting some of what level they'd up sorry, I don't know the term, upgraded the uranium to a certain level, were they getting it out before, you think?
Well, military is 60% concentration and above. For serious nuclear weapons, it's probably 85, 90. I doubt that was happening because, you know, the Americans moved very swiftly. And there was a reason for that. And they would have moved even more quickly. Because all of that's, you know, available to satellite surveillance.
So the reason I brought that up is, why do we keep siding with the enemy of America and then expecting them to say, oh, that's fine. You side with China, you side with Russia, you side with Iran, which we know why, because they give them cash, right? The chameleon will side with anyone who gives him money, it looks like. He doesn't care. So why do we keep doing that and expecting a different result? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
I'm now going to move on, but then you'll see the relevance in
those.
The next place that I spent some time after Botswana was Indonesia.
I said and Malaysia, sorry.
Yes, well Indonesia and Malaysia. It was the whole of the Southeast Asia, but mostly in Indonesia. Now, Indonesia was a very, very interesting country. It spreads, I think it's 13,500 kilometres east to west.
Sure.
It's got hundreds of thousands of islands. The big ones, you know, Sumatra, Java.
Oh, the big tourist destinations,
etc., etc., and obviously Bali. We all know about Bali and Lombok.
Yeah.
But there's many, many other. North of Jakarta, and Jakarta was the spice center where the old Dutch VOC boats were sailing to. That they stopped in Cape Town to pick up fresh water and meat, etc., etc., to enable them to get all the way to the Spice Islands.
VOC, that's a Dutch company, isn't it?
That's.
I tell you why I say that. I'm sorry to go off and distract you. I play for a cricket club called VOC in Rotterdam.
Absolutely.
And that would be association with it. And the guy who just retired from playing cricket, guess who he worked for and owned, or a shareholder. His name was, I can't remember his name now, a fast bowler. And he worked for a shipping company, VOC.
Oh, really? Well, VOC back in the 16th century was the biggest company in the world by far. You know, Holland, Netherlands was the centre of maritime trade, and a lot of that was with the East Indies, and a lot of it was based on spices, and later on tea and other things. And bringing the boats back. But what I wanted to touch on, so when I went to Indonesia, Sukarno had been the recent head, and Indonesia had at Bandung, the first non-aligned movement global conference was held in Bandung, which was a regional center in the middle of the Javanese island. And Sukarno was very much the head of that. And we say non-aligned, but fundamentally they were aligned to a communist view of the world. China at that stage was not the force it was. China only developed later, and we'll touch on that in a minute. So Sukarno had massacred, and no one really knows how many, but the general consensus is 500,000 of Chinese Indonesians. Ethnic cleansing. And the...
Really?
Absolutely. And because the Chinese were considered unfair. They owned all the trade, and they were picking on, and, you know, and the poor little Malay people, the Javanese people, the Malays, was suffering as a result. Suharto came to power and he changed all that. And he had a much more less jaundiced view of the world. And Indonesia started to open up, which is why I ended up there. British government's economic advisor in the area,
so you,
with a view to improving and enhancing British trade.
Yeah, brilliant.
And doing lots of the things that we, the Botswana had done. Trafalgar built up most of the roads, the railways were developed.
Were you involved in all of that as well in your time there?
Well, very much on in the roads. I'm director of the company, and very involved in development finance. Yep. A lot of it in conjunction with the State Bank of India,
sure,
which is a nationalised bank, and textile factories and textile business. Textiles is the route to the first stage to industrialization for almost every successful country. It's labor intensive, it's relatively low tech, the technology involved really hasn't changed much. You know, a loom, they're a bit faster, and it's an old fashioned clickety click process.
Well, you see, America now have done a deal with Vietnam and more or less taken a lot of that manufacturing away for China. They've priced them out of it and said, Vietnam, would you like to do this? And
yep,
we'll give you a decent rate and we'll look after you.
Yes.
I mean, that is really like poking China in the eye.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes,
as
yes,
a novice, just looking outside.
I think China's, to a large extent, moved on from textiles. I think, Thailand, Vietnam,
yes,
Indonesia, I think those are the big heavy techs, and obviously India itself.
Is that the start, though? What I was getting to, John, yes, they're doing that, but now all of a sudden China have been given pretty heavy tariffs at the moment, right? And they haven't come to a conclusion, is what I've read and seen. Is that a door opening for Vietnam to say, boys, what would you like to pick out of their shopping basket, and you can do it for us a bit cheaper? And you can buy our products, because that was part of the deal, what I saw with Vietnam. Vietnam have got now no tariffs on American products coming in. Is that right?
Look, I mean, all of this is a state of flux.
Yeah, yes.
And the primary negotiation and the arm twisting, there's lots of casualties, and South Africa's one of the casualties,
yeah,
let's say.
Big time.
But it's really aimed at rebalancing trade with China.
China, yeah.
And that's an ongoing debate. And the irony is that America needs China much more than China needs America. I hope that America wakes up. It's going to be on the losing end, unless things change. You can't bully your way,
yeah,
into forcing people to do something.
Yeah.
You can't. And Americans themselves, once they start, paying 30% tariffs,
yes,
on everything that they consume,
yeah,
Walmart is virtually everything there comes from China.
Yeah.
And Walmart is where America shops.
Correct. Yeah. Big discount store.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the biggest discount store in the world. There's one in every town. It's the biggest employer, and that's where America shops. So Americans are going to get cross as well. So I think we're still in. Let's watch and wait and see what happens.
What do you think over the next 6 months?
It's got to happen quicker than that, I think.
I was sitting at home saying, "Gee, wow! If I'm getting banged 40% and 50%, it certainly allows my rivals, who I had under control, to get it. If they've only got a 20%." They can come in and undercut me for the first time ever, because China were the biggest producer. So the reason I was talking about Vietnam, interestingly, the other day, there is an opportunity why this little argy-bargy is going on. You can actually steal a little bit. You might need all of it because you're only a smaller country, but you can start opening up the doors to producing something else than only you did. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree, but I think it's a watch and wait.
Okay.
And I think America's being very heavy-handed, but I think it will calm down.
It seems to back down. And then I looked yesterday, because I said to my wife, I'm going to look at the S&P 500, because the Democrats come out and said, when he put tariffs, the market's going to crash and whatever. Well, guess what? It's up from when he did do it. The markets are rebounded. And to be fair to Trump, he did come out and say, buy now. He told everyone.
Yeah.
And they jumped right back up again and are now higher than when he put the tariffs on.
Yeah.
Looking at that.
let me just go back to Indonesia, and it has relevance to this debate. So after Sukarno, you know, the disaster, Suharto was much more inclusive. He's married to his wife was called Tini, or popularly known as Tini Percent. 10% on everything. But anyway, that's fine. 10% was relatively modest. Suharto was at the time, he and his five generals ran the country. And I had a very close friendship with one of the general's daughters. I won't go into that. But, it gave me many insights.
Okay.
But so Indonesia was changing. Chinese came back in, invested, made lots of money. Some very famous multi billionaires Chinese made lots and lots of money. And about the same time, Chu Enlai, who was the Chinese premier at the time, visited Singapore. And Lee Kuan Yew, the most remarkable change of any place in the world, it has been Singapore. I first went there in 1979, and its change from then to now is just utterly remarkable. But Chu Enlai said, well, we knew these kind of places existed in America, but this is in Asia. How on earth did Singapore, you know, high-rise, successful, were in 1980, they were doing their MRT, the Mass Rapid Transport Underground, doing extraordinary things. And they had a plan. And Chu Enlai insisted that all Chinese regional premiers, state, you know, city people who run their cities, went to Singapore and they learnt about how to run a modern society. And China then started to take off. The first kickstart to the Chinese economy was returning Chinese expatriates who were said, look, just reinvest some of your money here and we'll take care of you and we'll make sure it's a good investment. And theirs went well, and then the Americans started piling in the early 80s, and China took off. And again, you know, time makes us forget. Back in the days of, you know, when Formosa and Chiang Kai-shek were there, China was a very, very poor country. I don't remember the film Chariots of Fire.
Oh, yes. Great movie.
I think his name was Little, I think. He wouldn't run on a Sunday. So he forfeited the gold medal. But he was a missionary in North China. And that was the state. You know, missionaries were as active in China as they were in Africa, and that was another advantage that that Botswana had. Missionaries had developed the schools, the hospitals. An uncle of mine was a missionary in Tanganyika.
Were they predominantly Christian in Botswana? Was it?
They were nearly all LMS, London Missionary Society.
Okay.
They were Church of England. They were the local vicar. The local church in Habaroni on Sunday was absolutely packed out, a Trinity Church, and religion. Missionaries were, you know, they rudimentary healthcare, education, etc., etc., etc. My cousin Diana married a young Tanzanian who was a doctor. Trained, learnt everything, was basically brought up in my uncle's house. I went to study medicine in England, fully qualified, and they got married. The marriage didn't last, but you know, it was missionaries were a major, they're kind of considered a bit patriarchal, a bit by South Africa, but they were a major force for good in Botswana and also in China.
Did China accept them openly and willingly?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
You know, China was very, very poor. It only became successful from the 80s, and 90s, and particularly the year 2000 onwards.
Who did that? Was that Reagan's term, or was that?
Which in the 80s?
Yeah, well, who was in the 80s?
It could have been
Reagan. Yeah,
Reagan was in 83. I'm not quite sure. And then towards the end, we know we're heading into Bush senior era.
But who pushed that towards China to help them evolve, develop, and then become the powerhouse that?
Well, Nixon was. He was the one that went across and and said, I think we can do business here. And he was the one that opened the doors for, the eyes of American business. And American business has done very, very well. Obviously, there's a lot of trade secrets were stolen and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's one thing I've noticed. Sorry, I keep interrupting you, but I've watched that. And I've listened to the guys, and a lot of big financial guys say, take your product and make it there before you wipe the sleep out of your eyes. They've developed a very similar product, and you've got patents on this product, and good luck trying to get it through the court system there, because you're going to get nowhere. And next thing you know, they're producing a very similar product, half the price, and actually putting you out of business.
I think that certainly was true, and that's how China developed. I think that China now is a major, major innovator. There are more patents, registered in China, I think, than there are in America these days.
Right.
You look at the chips, the modern chips. I mean, it's an incredibly complex process. The components of it are made all over the world, and the technology is made all over the world. Who owns that? I mean, America thinks it does.
Well, Taiwan have got that. They produce the most, don't they?
Taiwan are by far the majority of the market and are the cutting-edge innovators.
But I see Taiwan have done a deal with America to say, oh, come and build a factory here, so we're not reliant. If China comes and takes over Taiwan, which looks argy-bargy at the moment, and that guy, I watched him on the telly with Trump, saying no, he'll commit X amount of money to build a factory there, but the factory's not built yet.
No, it is.
Oh, is it built?
No, it's largely built. It's a huge factory in the middle of Nevada. But it's a very, very, very complex process. It's involves... it's technology way beyond my pay grade, but some of the very cutting edge technology is Swiss, some is German.
Yeah,
it comes from all over the world, and it all comes together and put together, and it's made effectively in a vacuum environment. Tolerances of, we're talking about a micron, which is it's a thousandth, ten thousandths of a human hair.
Yeah,
it's really, 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 cutting edge technology.
We were just on about the effects. I mean, if you come back to South Africa, they've got coming up the 700 million talk, and that's where we're getting. We started there, ended up over there because everything we see, look on the outside, look, I'm like, I'm just sitting on the outside reading, watching, listening, but we seem to be on a mission to only back the countries that annoy America. So I just don't understand that. Where there's got to be a time where you say, listen, China, you're a major trading partner. Listen, Russia, I know you're in part of BRICS, but he can't travel anymore, can he? He's in trouble with traveling, so he had to do it via Skype or whatever it was.
Mm.
And the Chinese guy said, I'm not coming.
Yeah.
So they're the two big players in BRICS, let's be honest. Not South Africa, not Brazil. India. India's huge now. They're quite big.
But looking at Botswana, Indonesia, and China, they've all changed. They've all recognized that compromise is the way to go.
Yeah.
China is no longer... It's people that call it a communist country, it's centrally controlled, undoubtedly, but its principles by which it operates are market driven. A lot of its core components might be state owned, but so is that in many, many countries. China is it's state controlled in as much as when Jinping says jump, they all jump.
Yeah.
How high?
Yeah.
And you think about some of their entrepreneurs who've come unstuck for a period of time and suffered. But China recognized they needed to modernize, they needed to get in, introduce elements of the modern world.
Yeah.
And that's what kick-started China. And the same thing, Suharto, Sukarno's way was nowhere, going nowhere. Vietnam changed. It's no longer communist. South Korea changed. Obviously, North is still. We are all part of a global world. We can't cut off. We need to trade and interact with everybody.
Yeah.
I think that's the message. Head in the sand. We are the ANC, we know everything and we know best, and that ours is the only way.
Don't tell us what to do, we know better. That's my favourite saying.
Absolutely.
Seems to be that way. John, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. It is now 29 minutes past two. Can you believe that? We've done an hour and a quarter and we've gone nowhere.
Oh dear.
I'd love to have you come back. I'm sure there's a lot more. A lot more to chat about. And I'm learning, and the great thing for me is that I learn off a guy like you who's been in those positions and whatever, and my mind looks at things and says that, and I know I'm way off, but I've got no other way of understanding why people do things over and over again. And as you rightly say, these countries learned, if we continue down that path, we're going to bang our heads, and it's not going to work. That's why I was really interested, and we did get off the track a bit, that $700 million they're spending. What is the dialogue going to be all about? It's great to talk, but actions have to come in. It seems to me that everything is locked up, and if this guy gets arrested, he's going to tell stories about that guy, and everybody's interlinked. And with that guy stepping out, and I apologise, I can't remember his name, in Durban, and having the guts to do that, because he's put his life in danger now, because he's messing with the big boys. Sorry, just what I'm viewing. But anyway, we can chat about that next week or the week after, when any of you avail. I'd love to have you back again. I'm sure everyone's been interested. I've learned a lot today, especially about the Zulu, the causes, and where they come from. And I tell you what, a lot of people in the world have got no idea. They think they were here originally, and it's not true. John, Quirk, thank you so much. We're going to go to a break. And, what do we got? 15 minutes to go. And then Big Greg, he'll be on his way. All right, let's go and have a listen to some stuff. Thank you very much for coming in, John.
Brilliant.